Welcome to episode 407. Do you forget stuff, or you're not quite as sharp as you used to be? Maybe you even have someone in your family with dementia, Alzheimer's disease, or some kind of cognitive decline. Believe it or not, but I do too. Sadly, my grandmother is showing very obvious signs of these three things, and medically speaking, there is very little they can do, at least in a doctor's office. But there's hope for you if you feel like you're starting to lose your mind a little bit. In this episode, we speak with Dr. John Lewis, a former associate professor at the University of Miami Miller's School of Medicine. This man has 180 peer-reviewed publications in scientific journals and was the principal investigator on over 30 of those studies. And in the process, he has found the specific molecules from carbohydrates, that's right, the horribly demonized carbohydrate, has huge therapeutic effects in patients with cognitive decline, dementia, and Alzheimer's disease. Along with this very hopeful nutritional discovery, he also shares why, as an associate professor, he left Western medicine due to the pharmaceutically driven medical system that was holding back his research and his ability to help people. This is a fascinating deep dive into the medical system and how you can begin reversing degenerative health issues. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Welcome back to another episode of the show. And as you may or may not know, this year it's my mission to coach 500 people to get control of their sugar cravings and sugar binges so they can stop yo-yo dieting, stop obsessing about food, and finally create a body that they feel confident being in. Now, the links to inquire about our premium health programs are in the caption below and or the show notes below, depending on where you're listening or watching. Now, I'm glad you're here with me because we've got a fantastic research scientist in Dr. John Lewis on the show, whose groundbreaking research paper that came out of his Alzheimer's disease study not only spurred him to leave academia, but he's now become a world-class supplement formulator in the space of brain health and cognitive decline. And we're not just talking about performance and focus supplements, but also to support people with dementia, Alzheimer's, and other brain and nervous system diseases. Dr. John, welcome to the show.
Maddie, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to our conversation today.
Me too. I really enjoyed getting to know you through some of the other podcasts and bits of content. Shout out to Lisa Tarmati, who connected us as well. So many of the listeners here or viewers here will know Lisa as well. But I think what would be a good place to start is, you know, in that conversation about brain function and dementia and Alzheimer's. I guess most people know that when they hear that, there's something wrong with the memory or the cognitive ability goes down over time. But maybe can we start with, if you can give us an overview of our current understanding of Alzheimer's disease, maybe from more of a mechanistic or a physiologic standpoint?
Sure, that's a great idea. So this is really probably arguably the most difficult to understand disease in terms of the process of it compared to anything else. And that's including cancer, heart disease, viral infection, anything else. In fact, there's even some sort of more recent, not necessarily yesterday, but like in the last few years, some more recent theories related to even early infection. So for example, herpes, hepatitis, these kinds of infections leading to a greater risk of neurodegeneration later in life. That's one of the more recent theories behind this disease. I'm sure many listeners, especially anyone who's had a family member with either Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia like vascular dementia or Lewy body, know how just terrible this disease is. I mean, really, to lose your mind compared to, you know, losing some physical capacity, in my opinion, is absolutely worse. But really, to answer your question, there is, unfortunately, again, there's no great scientific consensus about what causes neurodegeneration. So you had the classic theory related to beta amyloid, tau, plaques, all these different forms of proteins that sort of clump together and get in the brain to the point where they end up disrupting all of our neural pathways and even cause neurons to die. Lots of different pathology going on there. But there's actually, it's fascinating because this is such a heterogeneous disease that there are actually a lot of people who end up dying and they've donated their brain and their body to science, you know, for post-mortem type analyses. And so these people, there's a group of people who will have all of that type of pathology, but they never had Alzheimer's disease. Then there's another group of people that have Alzheimer's disease and they never had that pathology. And then there's a third group of people that have that sort of classic, all of that pathology, and then they were diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. So that's, again, it's very heterogeneous and there's just no great consensus. So you have all of that sort of historical beta amyloid, tau, plaque, tangle theory. Then again, you've got something more recent, as I mentioned, you know, this idea that you get infections earlier in life, and then somehow that infection, and actually I'll talk about that a little bit related to our research when we get to that point in the discussion, and how that may set you up for neurodegeneration. Then you have this thing more recently, I'm sure you're familiar with it, this type 3 diabetes. I mean, to me, that's a very gross oversimplification of what's going on there. But again, there are all these different theories that are kind of being thrown out there. And there's, again, just no consensus. The bottom line is, though, the brain is affected just like every other major organ and every other major organ system based on how we treat it. Now, if you have the mutations on both sides from both your mother and your father, the APOE4 mutation in your gene, that puts you at a greater risk of ultimately getting Alzheimer's. We know that to be true. If you have it on one side or the other, that also increases your risk. If you have it on neither side, then there is no genetic risk as far as we know. I mean, that really is the one gene that sort of drives that. But beyond that one group of, you know, that genetic predetermination, really what we're talking about, Maddie, is lifestyle. It's always about lifestyle. I mean, and I don't know about in your country, but in our country, so many people are almost like brainwashed to believe that everything is related to a genetic predisposition. And it's like, in my opinion, it's a way to sort of absolve yourself from responsibility of taking care of yourself, because it's so easy to say, oh, well, you know, my grandmother had breast cancer, my mother had breast cancer, and therefore I'm a woman, I'm going to have breast cancer. You know what I'm saying? Like, people just have this sort of default position to absolve themselves of responsibility because it's some genetic factor that they can't do anything about, which completely dismisses this more recent field of epigenetics that says you definitely can do things to either suppress or express genes, depending on, again, how you eat, how you exercise, whether or not you smoke, use tobacco, whether or not you drink or use alcohol, how well you manage your stress, do you sleep well, you know, all these other lifestyle things. So I think it's fascinating when you look at it from that perspective. And I don't think a lot of people necessarily looked at the brain the same way they looked at the heart or the liver or the kidneys or the pancreas or the gut or, you know, all these other major organ systems, in terms of how nutrition and exercise have such a profound impact on the brain, just like it does on every other major organ system.
Fantastic. You said so many things in there that I want to talk about. And I really resonate with what you said in regards to the genetic idea absolving people of personal responsibility. And I'll never forget that one of the very first light bulb moments for me when I worked in a cancer hospital, in the very like first month, a couple of weeks of working there, I thought, oh, you know, I was young, early 20s, and I thought I need to, you know, really get familiar with cancer and what it is. And so I literally started with, how does the public see cancer? And I had no natural inclination at that point. I wasn't a nutritionist at that point. And one of the first sentences on the Cancer Council website was that 90 to 95% of cancers are caused by diet and lifestyle, and that there's approximately 5 to 7% which are genetic. And that was my first light bulb to say, hang on, we're pumping out this genetic bad luck narrative to everyone, yet we're in this situation where it's actually diet and lifestyle. And the cancer industry itself has on its website as the first education piece that most of it is diet and lifestyle. And I asked my question, which seems naive at the time, like, was, why isn't this a building of nutritionists and naturopaths and personal trainers? You know, it's a building full of highly educated doctors. which are just going deeper and deeper on molecular mechanisms and structures. And so I really resonate with that idea that you just shared.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, look at, you know, and of course, since COVID, I think a lot of these, whether it's the Institute of Medicine, the World Health Organization, even in Australia, I know you guys have gone through a lot of suffering as well in terms of what the government has tried to do to you guys. But I mean, prior to COVID, you had, just exactly to your point, you had these large bureaucratic institutions making it very clear that very little of chronic disease could actually be attributed just to genetic factor. It was actually lifestyle was the overwhelming issue related to whether or not you got a chronic disease or not. And more specifically, nutrition, other than your very specific examples of, say, throat cancer, lung cancer, other types of lung disease related to cigarette smoking or tobacco use. Those are obviously very targeted reasons why you shouldn't use tobacco. But besides those cases or those particular types of diseases, generically speaking, nutrition is your overwhelming number one lifestyle factor, either working in your favor or working to your detriment in terms of what you're ultimately going to set yourself up for later in life. Obviously, we don't necessarily see so much of cancer, for example, in children. We've now had this definite increase of obesity and type 2 diabetes in children to the point where in the United States, type 2 diabetes used to be called adult onset diabetes. Now it's called type 2 diabetes because type 1 diabetes, which used to be called juvenile associated diabetes, the nomenclature had to be changed because all these young children were starting to get diabetes due to their eating all this crappy food and then getting overweight and then becoming diabetic. So, but yes, I mean, it's just so, it's painful to me how many people still today view whatever happened to their parents or their grandparents as saying it's like a death wish for themselves. I mean, I kind of grew up in that same mentality where, especially on my father's side of the family, my grandfather, my dad's father, and most of his siblings had some form of heart disease. But growing up in the South in the United States, you have, you know, all these types of behaviors that go along with that typical Southern diet. A couple of them smoked, a couple of them drank too much alcohol. And so they all ended up with either heart attack or stroke or both. And so I had this notion when I was a young kid of thinking, oh man, my grandfather and, you know, my aunts and uncles, they've all had these different forms of heart disease. That must mean I have some genetic predisposition to having a heart attack or a stroke later in life. And as I got old enough to process the information and really make a better judgment about what had happened to them, it wasn't that we have bad genes, it was that they had bad behavior.
Yeah, the environment that impacts the genes was the problem. I like the idea that it's not genetic issues that run in families, it's recipes and lifestyle that run in families that is the problem.
That's right. Exactly.
So does this mean that your realization, because it sounds like we had a similar kind of realization at different points of our career, this like bureaucratic nature that was peddling, you know, this idea to the masses, let's say, to the public and you know, the doctors within the system, the medical professionals within the system, you know, we have to go through this process of trusting the education, you know, in our early years because we don't really have necessarily the resources to interpret things differently. And I think many of us move into medicine and healthcare with, you know, some part of it is noble in the sense that it's like, I want to help people. And, you know, there's of course other people that are just like, I want to get paid lots of money and my dad wants me to be a doctor. But I think there's, you know, there's nobility for many people stepping into that space. So until the moment that you realize that it's a big business and helping people in a sort of a more wholesome or holistic way is not really an option and might even lead to you sort of losing your job. So I'm curious, is those realizations of the genetic narrative and the absolving of responsibility for people, is that the thing that led you to leave academia, feeling sort of disempowered as a researcher?
I wouldn't say that was the biggest part of it. What I would say that led me to leaving academics was really more to the relationships between how you maintain your status as a researcher in an academic institution, which is entirely driven by funding dollars. And so for somebody like me, a physiologist doing nutrition, dietary supplement, and exercise training research at a very conventional, conservative pharmaceutical funded institution like the University of Miami at the medical school, I was literally, Maddie, one of just a handful of people doing what I was doing at that time. And when we ran this study in Alzheimer's disease and we showed some incredible responses in our study and published the first paper using this polysaccharide formula, and then, man, I was on top of the mountain. I mean, I thought, oh my gosh, like I'm onto something here that could potentially be huge. But, you know, again, doing research is dependent on how much money you have in the bank to be able to pay yourself, your staff, your space, pay for the subject assessments, pay for, you know, all the laboratory fees, everything that's involved in running research. And so, oh, by the way, that only happened due to the generosity of a family member or a family who heard one of my colleagues giving a lecture. And he was talking about the work that he was doing. Dr. Reg McDaniel was talking about some of his work with people with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and he was using these polysaccharides to help them. And she felt very inspired, and she and her husband later decided to give a donation to research as long as the research was conducted in Alzheimer's disease. And Dr. McDaniel, not being affiliated with the university at that time, turned to me and said, "Hey, John, we've got an opportunity to do a study, but it has to be in Alzheimer's." And so that's really one of the reasons why I'm even sitting in front of you today talking about all this, is because of the generosity of one family. But really, to answer your question, it's because after that first article from our study was published in 2013, I tried on four occasions, two times from the National Institute of Health and two times from the Alzheimer's Association, to get these people to see what we had. And it wasn't just a proposal, an idea. It was a proposal with data and an idea to extend the work that we had already done. And so I went from being so, you know, so high, essentially so optimistic and so just full of energy and excitement, to getting rejected all four times. And then going from the top of the mountain, I didn't go to the valley, I went below it. I was like under the ground of, you know, being angered and sad and frustrated and aggravated and disillusioned and all those other things. And so I decided, not just like that, because I couldn't just leave like that. I had too many studies going that I needed to wrap up and finish and, you know, do my report, ensure that my commitments were fulfilled to the people I was working with at that time. But over that 4-year period, I decided to leave academics because I just refused to stay in an environment where I was so dependent on trying to convince bureaucrats who may publicly talk like they have an interest in nutrition, but meanwhile, when push comes to shove and they're shown something that has great potential and could really help people, the bottom line is they did nothing. And I did not want to spend, you know, another year, 5, 10, 20, whatever years I have left of my career and my life, banging my head against the wall, making it bleed, trying to, again, convince people of something when it's right there in front of your face. I mean, my goodness, can you not read this? And so the reality for me was I was dealing with people in an environment where if you're not doing research on either pharmaceuticals or genetics, which I certainly wasn't doing anything in the former. I have somewhat of an interest in linking nutrition and genetics, but it wasn't anything I was doing at that time. And so I realized in that very conventional environment, I didn't have any great potential or pathway to achieve what I wanted to achieve with the type of research that I wanted to conduct. And so for me, it was kind of like going from being on cloud 9 again to being completely disenchanted with the whole environment and just deciding to leave and go into the dietary supplement industry based on this research, because I felt like I had such an incredible opportunity to help people that would put me out of that environment where I was so restricted and dealing with all of these closed-minded, very conventional people that in reality really do not have much interest in nutrition.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that story. I think more people need to hear about these experiences of people that were willing to leave and willing to stand up, because I've had the experience, especially when I started this podcast. So this podcast is heading towards being 6 years old, and you know, we've released an episode every single week. And in the first few years, I was still in the cancer hospital. And there was instances that became more regular over time where people would sort of wait till everybody left the meeting or left, you know, whatever was going on, and they'd come up and say, "Hey, Maddie, I've been listening to your podcast, and actually what you say makes a lot of sense." And I say, "Oh, why don't you come on the podcast? Why don't we talk about this?" And they're like, "Oh, no, I can't lose my job. You know, I can't risk my income. I've got to feed my kids." And so I actually think there's a lot of people in the system that feel the same, but feel constrained, you know, financially or by status or by family or by whatever social means, that means that they can't leave and they can't follow what they believe to be their truth. So I think the story you shared in your journey, John, I think it's inspiring.
Well, I appreciate that. And again, I just refused. I guess I'm the kind of person that, you know, I'm willing to see things through. And I think my track record would suggest that in terms of, you know, the things that I've accomplished in academics and all the research that I conducted, all the publications that I've authored and co-authored. I mean, I definitely have the ability to follow through on many things and accomplish, I guess you could call them relatively short-term goals. But at some point, it was very obvious to me that I just could not continue in an academic environment. It just wasn't going to work out. The only thing that could potentially have kept me there would have been if I had met some really wealthy benefactor who had taken his own interest in what I was doing and said, "Okay, this is amazing work. I'm going to continue funding you as long as you want to continue doing this work." Had that, you know, had something like that happened, then it would have been very likely I would still be in academics today. But otherwise, you know, this idea of kissing up to people that didn't have any interest in what I was doing and to try to, you know, somehow convince them otherwise to fund what I was doing. And, you know, I don't know about in Australia, but in the United States, I mean, professors and academics are not making, you know, we don't make a great salary anyway. I mean, if anybody thinks that I've gone into the dietary supplement business because I'm now motivated by money or I want to become rich or whatever, well, man, I'm pretty stupid when it comes to trying to become rich, because I spent 20 of the best years of my life in academics that I'll never get back. And I didn't become rich, and I'm still not trying to become rich. I'm just trying to help people with some research that my colleagues and I conducted that now can actually benefit literally anybody who wants to take this particular formula. And that's what I'm trying to do. And that's why I'm sitting here tonight with you, is having another opportunity to share this message of our research and how beneficial these polysaccharides can be for people. And that's what motivates me every day. And every time I hear someone provide feedback and how much better they're feeling, or, you know, some other indicator of their current health status has changed to the better, then that's exactly what motivates and fuels me every single day to continue moving forward. Because the reality is that I'm a little fish in a gigantic pool, and it's, you know, it's really, really challenging to build anything from ground zero. I mean, talk about creating a company and a brand and all these things literally from ground zero. That's what I've been doing. And that's no bowl of cherries either. I mean, that's not an easy thing to do. I mean, I could have sold out and, you know, taken some job as a researcher for Big Pharma or some other biotech company and probably made a ton of money already by now in my life. But I had no interest in doing that. So that's why I'm here today. And I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing till I take my last breath.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the economic piece of being a researcher or working in medicine in different ways, because I remember when I would tell people that I worked at the cancer hospital, and people would say, "Oh my God, that's so noble. That's so amazing. You're such a good person." And there would be this assumption that I was on amazing money just because I'm working in this, you know, elite medical industry. And sure, I didn't have a high role. I was in my early 20s, beginning of my career, but it was just funny, that assumption. And I didn't ever actually make enough money to pay back my university debt, which we call HECS here in Australia, which means you're in a very low income bracket. So yeah, it's not all Lamborghinis and parties and yachts.
No, not at all. And the other interesting thing about, again, I don't know how well this translates to Australia, but in the United States, we have a saying called the ivory tower, in referring to people in academics. You know, in your ivory tower, you're in this sort of bubble, like you're insulated from the quote unquote real world, where, you know, your conception of the typical professor in the United States is some guy, you know, sitting around in his jacket and in his hat, his felt hat, and he's, you know, maybe smoking a cigar, and he's making all these statements that make him sound, you know, very intellectual, and he works with all these students that he teaches, and, you know, it's just this very sort of laid back, easygoing existence. That is complete nonsense. In the United States, in academics, as a researcher like me, first of all, I barely did any teaching. I mean, maybe 1% of my time was devoted to teaching. I was almost entirely spending my time as a researcher, maybe a couple of percentage points of my time for administrative responsibilities. I would be on different committees and whatnot, which we're expected to do. But the rest of my time was running my research. And let me tell you, it's as dog eat dog as any corporate position or any government position or whatever, because the bottom line is that it is completely dependent on funding. And if you don't have it, you will lose your job. And so it is as dog eat dog as any other thing, any other type of environment that I've worked in. And I have worked in a corporation. I have worked in politics. I've experienced and I've seen other environments. And now here I am as a businessman, as an entrepreneur. It's definitely not all of that, because I am sort of insulated in the sense of just working with my limited partners that I interact with, who I get along with really well, which is very satisfying and rewarding. But in terms of any type of big bureaucratic institution, academic research is not, I mean, man, you've got to be willing to basically work 7 days a week, 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and otherwise you can't make it. And I tell students when I occasionally give a guest lecture, I tell any of those undergraduate students, hey guys, if you are considering any kind of a research career at this point in your life, you better be willing to bust your butt, because if you don't, you'll never make it. If you approach it as just like some 9-to-5 job like a banker, you won't make it. You will get eaten alive.
Mum, mother, grandmother, nan, nana, and women with no kids. Have I got your attention? So I want you to imagine something. Go with me here. Imagine a life where even when you wake up tired and the kids are driving you mad and work sucks and things are problematic, that you're still in control of your food and you still make healthy choices without giving up and binging on chocolate and wine and saying, I'll try again tomorrow. It might be hard to imagine, but having freedom with your food is absolutely possible. And it starts by getting three things right. One, having a supportive community, building a strong connection with fellow emotional eating warriors. Two, having the right information delivered in the right way. And three, having a guide that can shine a light on the right path and have your back along the way. And that's me. Those three things are exactly what we've got for you inside the Healthy Mums Collective Facebook group, for people just like you wanting to end their emotional eating and feel good in their own skin again. And currently, it's free to join. The link is in the show notes below. If you've struggled with diets or felt powerless around food, you're not alone. But let me assure you, this is a community that understands your battles and is ready to empower you into action. So what can you expect on the inside? Well, we have posts and content that push you a little out of your comfort zone. We do Facebook Lives, have interactive Q&A session, and it's simply a safe space to face your food challenges and be honest without concern of being judged. If you decide to join us, I have a complimentary How to Turn Food into Self-Confidence ebook for you as well, completely free. The Healthy Mums Collective thrives on support, authenticity, and experience-based practices. It's a community, so the beautiful people in it is where the magic comes from. To join us and be a part of that magic, head to the show notes, click the link, breeze through a few quick questions, and you'll be in the Healthy Mums Collective before you know it. Again, the link is in the show notes below. I'll see you in the DMs or on the welcome post in just a few moments. I definitely have memories of going into the lab at 4 a.m. or an assay was due to be finished at 2 in the morning or 3 in the morning, and I'd go to a party first on the weekend, and on the way home I'd stop by the hospital and head into the lab for a few hours, and you know, get home really late, like I'd partied all night. And I was like, well, half the night was party, half the night was going back to work on a Saturday night. So,
but exactly.
But so I'm curious though. So, you know, that's obviously the medical career and sort of the chapter that's behind you. But maybe tell us a little bit about that polysaccharide paper that did give you that feeling of being on top of the mountain, you're really heading somewhere, and sort of why, I guess, now that's translated to supplements and helping people in that way.
Well, thank you for that. So I will start by just saying that I met two people about 20 years ago who completely changed not only my career, but my life in terms of what they shared with me that, again, just was so profound. I had no clue. I mean, what I learned about saccharides in general was probably one or two lectures in biochemistry as a student. And all I really knew about polysaccharides or saccharides at that point was just that they are basically, you know, fuel for the cells. That was really my entire conception or perception of what saccharides were. And so I met this gentleman, Dr. Reg McDaniel, a pathologist by training who had turned to practicing nutrition after being introduced to an aloe vera product. And then I met this lady, actually a patient from the cancer center here at the University of Miami, who had introduced me to her story with a rice bran polysaccharide. And these two people didn't know each other, but for whatever act of the universe or just, you know, call it timing, luck, I don't, you know, fate, whatever, I don't know, you know, I can't explain that, but they both came into my life around the same time, about 20 years ago, shared with me their stories, and then it took me in a road of studying these polysaccharides that, again, completely changed my life. And so one thing that I think is important to share with your listeners is that, you know, we, and again, I'm sorry, I'm sharing the American experience. It may not correlate with the Australian experience, but we have been told over and over for at least the last half century that all sugar is bad. And it drives me crazy from a perspective of as a scientist, as a writer, as a technical writer, and somebody who's very particular about the use of the language, that word is just completely misused. So sugars are really dependent on two primary characteristics in terms of determining whether or not a sugar is good or bad for us. And so there are three basic types. You have, as you know, the monosaccharide, something like high fructose corn syrup. I think everybody generally agrees if you're eating that monosaccharide every day, you're spiking your insulin, you're spiking your glucose, you're setting yourself up for metabolic complications that probably are not very good for you down the road. And then you have a disaccharide like sucrose or white table sugar. Again, kind of the same thing applies. If you're eating sucrose every day in great amounts, you're probably doing yourself no favors. But then you have polysaccharides, these very highly complex molecules or compounds of literally hundreds of glucose units attached together by these glycosidic bonds. And the two that we studied, again, from aloe vera and rice bran, I would put up against just about anything else that Mother Nature provides for us in terms of their health-promoting benefit. And so these polysaccharides are just very dense in information, and they're complex sugars. So I just like to be mindful of the fact that anytime I hear somebody lump all sugar in the same basket, it's kind of like the old saying of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. That's not really factual, and it's actually not true because, again, it depends on where the sugar comes from and its biochemical complexity. So I just like to sort of couch where I am today in that context because I think it's important, again, to just be mindful of the language and just to please use it properly. Please remember that sugar has to be put in the proper context before you just dismiss all sugars as bad for you. But these polysaccharides, Maddie, from aloe vera and rice bran, again, I would put up against just about anything else that Mother Nature provides for us. I mean, curcumin obviously has been very widely studied. But what we showed in our Alzheimer's study in particular was the most, even to date, the most rewarding work that I've done as far as being a scientist. We put people that had moderate to severe Alzheimer's disease, which is the worst, basically the worst form of it. And it's the level of severity where big pharma doesn't really care for those people in terms of, you know, trying to figure out what to do for them. I mean, big pharma will look at you if you have mild cognitive impairment or even maybe mild dementia. But when you get to the moderate to severe stage, forget it. Big pharma doesn't even have any answers for you, let alone, you know, what their interests in research are. And so we enrolled those people on our formula. We put them on it for 12 months. We assess their cognitive function at baseline 3, 6, 9, and 12 months. Unfortunately, we only had enough money in the budget to draw blood at baseline in 12. But what we showed in our study was nothing short of remarkable. We showed at 9 and 12 months, clinically and statistically significant improvements in cognitive function. These were people, again, with moderate to severe Alzheimer's, on average 79.9 years of age. And they didn't just have Alzheimer's, they had diabetes, depression, different forms of heart disease. These were very old, very sick folks. The ADAS-Cog that we use to do this testing is widely considered to be the gold standard for assessing cognitive functioning, particularly among people with dementia. It's been published, oh gosh, in thousands of studies going back to the 1970s. So it's, again, widely considered to be the gold standard for assessing cognitive function. Now, compare our results in this population to anything else. The five FDA-approved drugs for dementia, forget it. You're lucky if you have like a, you know, a stabilization of your condition, or maybe you delay progression, but eventually you'll just keep falling off the cliff. Any type of diet, any other dietary supplement, exercise, hyperbaric oxygen, acupuncture, red light therapy, sound therapy, music therapy. Literally, there is nothing else that has showed the effects that we showed in our study. And I want people to understand, because I specifically mentioned clinically and statistically significant. What does that mean for those of you not, you know, understanding very much statistic talk? Well, you can have very large numbers in a study. You can have a lot of people. You can have a lot of assessments. The law of large numbers says if your numbers are high enough, you will have statistical significance, meaning that it's some outcome not due to chance, just because you have large numbers. But is it clinically or practically meaningful? And so on the ADAS-Cog, any change in the score, 4 points or greater, good or bad, means that it's clinically significant, means that it actually has some relevance to real-world application. So that's why I wanted to mention and explain it to be very clear that we showed, again, clinically and statistically significant improvement in cognitive function. And again, there's nothing else like it in the literature. To support that at the cellular level, we showed an increase in overall immune system function according to the CD4 to CD8 ratio. Our CD4 cells are our helper cells. Our CD8 cells are our cytotoxic cells. So it's important to keep that ratio optimal, not just for people with Alzheimer's, but actually for all of us as we go through the lifespan. We showed decreases in TNF-alpha and VEGF. Those are two inflammatory proteins commonly looked at in heart disease and cancer. Our paper was probably the first paper that showed that finding in people with Alzheimer's disease. And then finally, in that first paper, we showed just under a 300% increase in CD14 cells. CD14s are a marker of adult stem cells. It's been shown in other research that CD14s can actually turn into neurons. So neuroplasticity 20, 30, 40 years ago was not accepted. People did not believe that the brain could actually regenerate itself. Now that we have been able to determine that the brain can, one of the reasons why is due to these CD14 cells. We showed just under a 300% increase in 3D in the CD14 cells from baseline to 12 months. So you put all these things together at the cellular level to support the clinical finding on the cognitive function side. And you can see why I was so excited at that point in my life, at that point in my research career, why I thought we were onto something so enormous and so impactful. And yet I got nothing else in response from either the NIH or the Alzheimer's Association. But, you know, I am so proud of that work, because that study, Maddie, was, I mean, it was intense, man. I mean, it was. We ran that study for about 2.5 years, and it was a lot of work, but it was just, it really is what spurred me to, as you mentioned in our introduction, to ultimately leaving academics and starting this company that I now have, Daily Brain Care, as the flagship product based on that study, plus our study in multiple sclerosis under the Dr. Lewis Nutrition brand. But man, we published 3 more papers after that first one, including a paper just this past year. So that's 4 articles that we've published from our Alzheimer's study. And then we published three articles from the MS study. So a lot of work has gone into this. And, you know, I'm not doing what I'm doing now in dietary supplements just to make money. I'm trying to help people with conditions and situations that otherwise, from a conventional medical perspective, really don't have a lot of alternatives or choices.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic what you're doing. And I really love that nutrition comes into this. I have a bias naturally. I'm a nutritionist. So I think it's awesome that nutrition, you know, can be found as a solution or at least an aid to be able to help these things. But I'm curious to go a bit deeper and to sort of broaden my understanding as well as everybody listening. Like the polysaccharides, exactly what are they doing in regards to that stem cell stimulation or creation of or development of the CD14 cells? Like what's the sort of mechanism going on there?
Well, it's not like when you look at different mechanisms related to, say, vitamins or minerals in comparisons, you mentioned doing lab work and running assays and whatnot. I mean, there are various assays that you can utilize for looking at how vitamins and minerals function in different ways. But with polysaccharides, it's not exactly so simple. In fact, there is very little assay, to my knowledge, that you can actually look at in terms of how these polysaccharides function mechanistically. But what seems to be true, and this is, I guess you could say, a bit theoretical, but nonetheless, based on all these different responses that we've published, and again, it's not just from our lab, it's from other investigators around the world looking at these two particular polysaccharides, it seems to be that there's something within these polysaccharides that they're essentially like signaling mechanisms for the immune system. So what does that mean? Well, we kind of use the term immunomodulation to sort of cover like this big umbrella of all these different activities. So again, whether it's lowering chronic inflammation or inflammatory markers, whether it's modulating the CD4 and the CD8 cells, whether it's in the last paper that we published from the Alzheimer's study, it's actually balancing the TH1, the pro-inflammatory, to the TH2 anti-inflammatory components of the immune system. In the MS study, we actually showed lowering of infections. The people with MS went from 7.9 infections at baseline to 2.5 infections at 12 months. So there's definitely a component there of these polysaccharides being very anti-infectious. Another thing that we showed in the MS study is that they actually turned on the FAS gene, the FAS gene, which is kind of like the genetic corollary to the CD4-CD8 ratio. It's actually the genetic marker, if you will, of immune system functioning. So there's definitely a genetic relationship there as well. We also showed in the MS study turning on EGF, epidermal growth factor, which is very important for remyelination, even though people with MS typically don't die from demyelination. They actually die from infection. So that infection finding was very important. But the remyelination to be able to help the nerves, you know, come back to life and be able to actually talk to each other again, that's very much driven by EGF, epidermal growth factor. So we showed that was also turned on by these polysaccharides. So again, kind of generically speaking, to answer your question, I would say that there's something, I think it's actually beyond biochemistry, quite frankly. I think there's something potentially on the physics level related to resonant frequencies with these particular polysaccharides, and then how that relates to either our genes or our cells. And that's a line of research that I really do hope to get into at some point. I've stopped running around with my handout asking people for money for research. I've just decided I'm going to make my business, my company, successful enough to be able to fund those kinds of research questions at some point in the future. But I truly do believe, I mean, there are lots of plants in the plant kingdom that have polysaccharides. I think, you know, two other classes, of course, are seaweeds and mushrooms. We know that different types of exotic mushrooms and seaweed have very high polysaccharide content. So I can't really speak to their capacities like I can aloe vera and rice bran, but I do believe that perhaps this is actually beyond biochemistry. There's just something very special about time and time again, all of these different effects. I didn't even mention, for example, the natural killer cell cytotoxicity and function that the polysaccharides also have a very significant effect on. So, you know, again, it's just like generally speaking, I would call them signaling mechanisms for the immune system to be able to turn on whatever, or turn off actually, whatever component needs to be turned on or turned off. And it's almost functioning like a, like an adaptogen in a way. Like it's, you know, it's, it all comes back to balance, right? I mean, whether you want to look at it as part of the overall approach to homeostasis, which I think immunomodulation, even though classically it's not considered part of homeostasis, I think there's definitely something to be said for keeping the immune system in balance, because as you know, the immune system is much more than just our first line of defense against infection. It's actually like the conductor of the symphony orchestra. If you have all the other organ systems being the symphony, the immune system is like the conductor, and it's talking to all the other major organ systems to help keeping those in balance and working properly. And so if your conductor is not in balance, you cannot possibly expect all your other parts of your symphony to be in balance. And so for me, that's why this is just so, this story of, you know, all these different inflammatory and immune system markers we've looked at over this 20-year period and all this data we've published, again, it always comes back to some degree to immune system function.
That's incredibly interesting. And I think when you mentioned the physics level resonant frequencies, it made me think of Jack Cruz's work. And I thought, oh, there's some really juicy possibilities down that pathway of conversation. But the thing that I guess is interesting in the context of this conversation and sort of maybe things that, you know, people watching or listening understand is I'm really interested in the connection between infection and cognitive decline, because like is what happens there is the situation that the immune system is effectively distracted and or worn out by dealing with infections over the lifetime. And then by the time we get sort of to a little bit older, you know, I guess middle-aged / elderly, the immune system is beginning to move into an immunosenescent situation where the immune cells are tired and worn out? Or is it simply that the immune system is distracted with more immediate priorities?
Great question. I would say it's a bit of both. And I'm glad you brought that back up again, because the fourth paper that we published from our Alzheimer's study at the end of last year, and I don't think I've shared with you any of our papers yet. I know I sent them to Lisa, but I'll be happy to send you all of those. But we showed for the first time, again, I hope I don't sound too arrogant or too egotistical about our work, but we actually characterized for the very first time the TH1 to TH2 ratio in people with Alzheimer's disease. Before we published that paper, I spent several hours on PubMed looking for any other paper that had characterized the TH1 to TH2 ratio in people with Alzheimer's, and I couldn't find it. I had one of my co-authors do the same. He couldn't find any other paper. So we actually published data that show that the TH1 to TH2 ratio in people with moderate to severe Alzheimer's was through the roof TH1 dominant. So you had all this pro-inflammation. And so you ask the question, well, why is that? And the other question you ask, you know, every time you run a study, you always, at the end of the day, you say, man, I wish I had collected, you know, X, Y, or Z variable. Well, in this case, the variable I wish we had collected was infection data. We didn't collect anything related to either infection titers or even current infection. So we don't know if those people had, you know, high titers for, say, some form of herpes, Epstein-Barr, cytomegalovirus, all these other things that are so common. But it almost makes perfect sense, exactly to your point, that these folks with Alzheimer's were so pro-inflammatory, they probably had at least one of the components to what was happening to them was this body's constant ongoing battle with infection. And so therefore, you know, try to like go back in time and say, okay, when did you start having all these different infection episodes? And then up to that point of, you know, people in their 70s, 80s, I think the oldest lady we had in the study was 93 or 4. But it makes perfect sense when you put that in the context of immunosenescence. You nailed the term, like, you know, after several decades of dealing with all these infections, and now you're immunosenescent and your body's doing its best to try to counteract all this stuff. And you just have all these pro-inflammatory markers through the roof. So that's one question that I want to answer. And again, in my own hopefully wildest dreams of coming up with more funding to do a next study in Alzheimer's, that will absolutely be one of the things that we will assess in terms of, you know, other things we could have looked at would be definitely infection status both currently and as much as we can determine historical. So I think it's very important to put that in the context of what you just mentioned. But yes, I completely agree with you.
As you were discussing or sharing what you just said, what popped up into my head was also a historical perspective. And what I mean by that is, if we think about, you know, 2024 is maybe arguably the cleanest year that we've ever had, right? So I'm sort of factoring in this immunosenescent infection-based reality that influences negative cognitive decline in regards to the theory of the hygiene hypothesis. So I'm curious, historically speaking, did we have more of this cognitive decline 500 years ago, 10,000 years ago, or is it at its absolute maximum now? And is that infection driven because possibly we're in the cleanest time we've ever been in with, you know, the hygiene hypothesis, and maybe that stimulates sort of maybe, and I'm sort of going down a rabbit hole here, but like more of an immune response, an autoimmune response because of a lack of infection or a lack of work by the immune system? Or is that where the type 3 diabetes, insulin resistance, obesity conversation comes in?
Yeah, these are great questions too. I mean, when you go back to, you don't even have to go back 500 years ago. I think in the so-called Old West of the United States, like in the 1870s, 80s, I think life expectancy was like 38 years old. So, yeah. You know, like you're dying at a very young age, not even 200 years ago. And so nobody lived to be old enough to have neurodegeneration. You were already being taken out by, you know, some form of infection that there was no treatment for, or you got shot, you know, something either very acutely traumatic or some infection that your body had no resistance to. But it is fascinating to, you know, consider those things. I mean, it'd be, and I would love, you know, let's say hypothetically, I do have the funding to do another study at some point in the near future, I'd love to brainstorm some of these variables that, you know, you think would be important to include in the next study. And then depending on what kind of budget we have, being able to incorporate as much of that into the research as possible. But I clearly believe, based on some of these other studies or some of these other articles I've been reading about the link between infection and neurodegeneration, how important that variable would be to be collected in a new study. It would be highly important and relevant.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, so I've got so many questions that are sort of teeming out of my science brain, like, what about this? What about this? What about this?
Right. So, right, exactly.
But in regards to the supplements that you've put together, like, sort of, who are the kinds of people that can benefit? You know, at what stage of the dementia diagnosis or Alzheimer's diagnosis should people look into supplements like these? And the other question as a nutritionist is, can people just eat these foods, you know, brown rice, mushrooms, you know, aloe, their whole life and use that as a form of prevention?
These are both great questions. I mean, in my view of the world, and I, you know, this maybe doesn't sound like the best, you know, from a marketing perspective, but I look at these polysaccharides as beneficial to every single person, and I'll tell you why. So I've been on my own formula for over a decade. I've had my mom on it for 12, 13 years. My wife started taking it a little over 5 years ago when she was pregnant with our daughter. Our daughter, when she turned 6 months of age, we started introducing solid food to her. I started putting her on this formula. So I say all of those anecdotes for a couple of reasons. One, because, you know, I'm standing behind what I sell. I mean, I'd be the biggest hypocrite in the world if I was selling something that I didn't take for myself and have my own family on. But number two, my daughter from literally 6 months of age, and the only reason I didn't put her on it before the 6 months is because the particles of the formula are a bit big for the size of the hole in the nipple to, you know, give her something to drink. So really, until she was about 6 months of age, I couldn't logistically give it to her. And then my mother, being elderly, I won't tell you my mother's age. She's very sensitive about her age. But I say that, you know, literally everybody from cradle to grave can benefit from these polysaccharides because, again, they're just so dynamic and so beneficial to literally every cell in our body. Now, in terms of, you know, for somebody with neurodegeneration or even some other type of health challenge, I think, you know, we probably need, for that person, and I try to work with people individually as much as I can, although running a business is not really, you know, one-on-one coaching either. I've got a lot to do, but I do try to help as many people as I can to try to individualize the dose in terms of, you know, if somebody has advanced Alzheimer's disease or multiple sclerosis or cancer or heart disease or whatever the case may be. Now, to answer your question about food, on the aloe vera side, I would say it's almost entirely unlikely that you could drink enough of the aloe vera gel to get the polysaccharide content to have a therapeutic or physiological benefit. So what do I mean by that is that the gel is 99% water. So imagine trying to drink all of that gel just to get enough polysaccharide content from that gel would be pretty unlikely. As far as the rice bran goes, well, first of all, 70 to 80% of the rice sold in the world is white rice. So the rice bran has been stripped off of that. So for those of you who only like to eat rice, or I'm sorry, white rice, you're actually not getting any of the bran, which is the best part of that plant. And even if you ate brown rice every day, I'd say, you know, again, kind of similar to aloe vera, it's probably difficult to get enough of it, especially if you have a very serious existing health challenge, to get that therapeutic or physiological concentrated amount that you need that, you know, again, if you concentrate it into a powder like what we've done with our products, to be able to get that effect. And so certainly getting it through food, especially eating, you know, the mushrooms, the brown rice, even different forms of seaweed. Man, I mean, absolutely add those to your diet where you can. But we've really, in a way, done the hard work for people in terms of concentrating these two polysaccharides into what we think is a concentrated dose that time and time again, we've showed is very beneficial for people. So we've really done the hard work for you and made it very simple.
Yeah, I think you're doing fantastic work and I love what you're doing and I love this conversation. And obviously everybody listening probably knows somebody that has dementia or Alzheimer's. I know that my own grandmother is going down that path. However, the challenges are that I am her grandchild. So my word comes with zero authority over her doctor, unfortunately. So, but for everybody listening, where can they find you and your products online?
So the best source of information in terms of our research, all the articles we've written, videos, podcasts like you and I are doing tonight, other sorts of product reviews, testimonials would be on the drlewisnutrition.com website. That's Dr. No period Lewis, L-E-W-I-S nutrition.com. You can find me on all the typical social media channels under Dr. Lewis Nutrition as well. And then Daily Brain Care, as I mentioned, is our flagship product that originated and is based on all of this research that we've published from the Alzheimer's and multiple sclerosis studies.
Fantastic. I'll pop all of those links down below. And I guess the final question that I love to ask everybody is, what is one piece of health information that you wish more people knew about?
Well, I think, you know, we've touched on it, especially here in the last couple of segments of the conversation. And that is, you know, I don't know about you, Maddie, but before, again, 20 years ago, when I met Dr. McDaniel and Barbara, I knew nothing about the potential of these polysaccharides from aloe vera and rice bran. So I would just hope that people find inspiration in what I've shared with you this evening, and they understand that these polysaccharides, regardless of the type of diet you eat, I mean, I think that's, you know, diet is one thing, and I'm certainly not telling anybody that you can supplement your way to good health if you're eating at McDonald's every day. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is that these polysaccharides can be, you know, put on top of a good diet. And I know that's a very debatable topic as well, but I just hope that people appreciate the fact that my colleagues and I have spent all these years, literally decades of combined research to show and to bring to the world this kind of information that these polysaccharides from aloe vera and rice bran can be just so incredibly beneficial for all of us. And oh, by the way, don't wait till you get sick. Use them as your preventative strategy to help you from getting these nasty diseases of aging in the first place. And so I just have this message about polysaccharides that I'm trying to get out to the world. I don't think a lot of people are really talking too much about them. And I hope that if just one person listening to you and me today feels inspiration and gets help from this, then that to me was worth it. And so I'm just trying to, you know, one life at a time, basically share a message of hope and inspiration, especially for people that are feeling maybe desperate and like the conventional system is not helping them in any way, that perhaps these polysaccharides can make a huge difference in someone's health status. And that's what I'm going to continue doing till my last breath.
Amazing. Well, you're doing fantastic work, and I really appreciate your time and energy on this show to share it with all of our viewers and listeners. And obviously we could talk for hours, so we'll have to get you back on at some point in the future. But thank you so much for being here, and we'll catch you really soon.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to coming back anytime you want to have me.
Perfect. Thanks, mate. See you later.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast. Simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember, too, that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.